Have you seen Chuck Norris lately? He's still kicking butt and staying active well into his 80s. What's even more shocking is he looks more jacked than ever and seems to have more energy than guys half his age. And it's all thanks to Morning Kick, a revolutionary new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade and has hundreds of five-star reviews. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 today. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
They are Sports Illustrated.
It's amazing.
This incredible body of work.
I really appreciate the integrity.
Everything you do is well done.
You guys do a great job.
We love it. What can we say?
He's Chris Mannix.
He's employed by Sports Illustrated.
The announcer's got it in for me.
There you go.
This is the Crossover NBA Podcast.
We have a problem with it. Build a team that can beat them.
Hosted by the one and only.
Oh, thank God.
Thank God.
Chris Mannix.
And we are back. A crossover, open floor, collaboration. Chris Mannix, Chris Herring, Rohan Nadkarni. Still live from his basement. I can't help myself with that. I can't. Every time I see you pop up on the video screen in what looks like a college dorm, I have to comment on it. I'm sorry, man. I have to.
I mean, you are looking like you're coming from a CIA black site. I just want to point that out. It's just you in front of a black,
possible,
blank,
I am.
Brown
possible.
Wall. Like, I don't. Oh man. I didn't realize you were still, on some kind of covert mission.
Certain
okay,
areas.
Yeah.
Still decorating certain areas of this office, but you know, it's you've got the tank top going on with the crappy blue curtain behind you. It's like, what are we doing? What are we doing here? You're a grown man. Come on, clean it up. All right, so Rohan, you led last week's podcast, and you hit some substantive, meaty topics. That's not what I do when I'm leading the show. I go for the lowest of low-hanging fruit, the catnip for listeners. So on this episode, we are going to get into the MVP debate. We're going to talk about the state of the Lakers. And I'm going to ask the question, is Michael Jordan's legacy tainted by what appears to be the end of his decade-plus run as majority owner of the Charlotte Hornets? So let's start with the MVP vote because, look, this has been a toxic debate for weeks and weeks, months and months now.
Years.
You know, I wrote about this. Well, no, I mean, it's more toxic now than it's ever been before. And I wrote about this on Tuesday on SI.com in kind of the aftermath of Doc Rivers kind of being asked about it before Monday night's game and sort of lamenting how if you support one guy, you then have to seemingly hate the others. Right, and we're talking about what is effectively a three-player race at this point between Nikola Jokic, the two-time reigning MVP, Joel Embiid, the two-time reigning runner-up, and Giannis Antetokounmpo has got a couple of MVPs on his mantle as well. So, you know, we'll get into the toxicity of it and why that's the case in a minute. But is your vote, fellas, and we'll start with you, Herring, real or mythical? Is your vote still up for grabs as we enter the final 2.5 weeks of the regular season?
Well, unless I get a notification soon that I don't have a vote, I did have one last year, a real one, so I'm expecting to be asked to do it again. It's still up for grabs, and I'll say that as someone that, as of about a month, maybe a little bit less than a month and a half ago, I think I even wrote that it was looking like this was going to be a third straight MVP for Jokic. And obviously, when you talk about the run that just as of last night, the Sixers lost for the first time in 9 games. And at the same time that the Nuggets, I think, have lost 6 out of 8 and, you know, took the last couple minutes to win those last, you know, those two that they actually did get, one of which was against the Pistons. So Jokic has still performed well statistically in those games. But just the nature of why I think we were seeing the race shake out the way it was like the Nuggets were dominating. Jokic has been dominant and was dominating at maybe a higher level than he had the last couple of years. And, you know, the Sixers were good, even though Embiid was dominant too. And so it wasn't stunning to me that, you know, that once we saw things come together the way they had, that Jokic kind of had built up a lead, so to speak. It's tightened just because the Sixers have played much better and the Nuggets have played much worse. It's kind of what always happens. It kind of feels like more of a traditional race, so to speak, because of the fact that the, you know, the teams are playing the way they're playing. And I think it's getting more attention. Add into that now what you're talking about the toxicity of it. And I don't think the race is tightening because of that, but it has kind of forced people who might not have even really taken notice of what was happening with the MVP race to look at it and say, like, why was Jokic the favorite? And by that, I mean fans, by the way. But why was Jokic such a favorite when Embiid was putting up these numbers? And then add to that the fact that, you know, that the Sixers went on a nice run and the Nuggets had a slide. So it's been interesting, frustrating. I think it's kind of interesting timing, too, for all of it to happen at the same time. But in a nutshell, despite the toxicity, I'm excited that there's a race to be had as opposed to it being kind of a runaway the way it started to feel at one point last year and even the year before that when there were a lot of injuries. So this is what we should want, is for the last few weeks to matter beyond teams tanking to try to get a certain opponent or teams tanking to get a draft pick. Like, it's a year full of parity, and I think that the MVP race is not parity because it's just two or three guys, but I'm excited that we've got a tight enough race to actually talk about that matters.
Yeah, I don't have a vote. I guess it's because I'm not named Chris. I don't know what's going on there. I'll have to reach out to someone at the NBA. But I'll say that my vote's definitely up for grabs. I think, like a lot of people, I have a front runner. I think my front runner has changed throughout the course of the season. Something that bothers me so much about the discourse around this award, and I think what really kicked it off this year, was, you know, ESPN does that straw poll of reporters for MVP, and Jokic was the runaway leader the last time they did the straw poll, which was it's been a couple months now. And I think there was a lot of backlash. Why is Jokic so far out in front? Why is he a near unanimous? And that kind of kicked off a whole new round of arguments. And I think those same people who had Jokic number one runaway at that point, I bet a lot of people have changed their minds, and that's okay. That's how the race should go. The more evidence you get, the more data points you collect, the more you watch, the better information you have and the better decision you make. And I think there was a point where Jokic was my front runner. I don't think that's the case anymore. And I just think that we need to, like, make it okay to change your mind about the MVP over the course of a season. For some reason, it feels like, if you champion a guy, like last year, I wrote a big story. I mean, Mannix, you wrote an Embiid story. I wrote a Jokic story. I think we both made good arguments. And, you know, because I listed why I think Jokic should win and compared him to Embiid in certain categories, it's like you get put into a camp. And it's like, you don't think Embiid's good at this. And it's like, I'm not insulting a player by saying he's the second or third best player in the NBA. You know what I mean? Not to mention, we also do our top 100 rankings where we put Giannis near the top. You know, we put Embiid over certain people. So, my vote's definitely up for grabs. I'm sure I'll write an awards column toward the end of the season, and that will be my final decision by then. But I think we need to make it normal to change your mind about the MVP over the course of a season.
Well, look, minds have changed over the last, mm-hmm. you know, 3 months. If you go back to that first ESPN straw poll, Jason Tatum was the leader on that straw poll. A couple of months later, in mid-February, it was Nikola Jokic, and there are reasons for that. I mean, Nikola Jokic at that point was posting ridiculous numbers, averaging close to a triple-double, which he still is, leading in all the major advanced statistics categories, and Denver was the top team in the Western Conference by a considerable amount. Those are all pretty elemental criteria for positioning a guy as the front runner for MVP. But things have changed in the last month. That's why my vote right now is completely up for grabs. I mean, in the last month, I don't think Jokic has taken a step back, but to Chris's point, the Nuggets have. I mean, they lost four straight in mid-March. As we record this, they've lost five of their last seven. They still have a pretty strong grip on the top seed in the West, but you know, this is a tough time, at least for the MVP vote, for Jokic to have his team be struggling, because while this team struggles, his defensive deficiencies get highlighted. And that's always been the anti-Jokic argument, that as marvelous as he is offensively, defensively sucks, especially compared to, you know, Joel Embiid and Giannis Antetokounmpo. So it's certainly opened the door. And while Jokic and the Nuggets have struggled, you've seen Embiid go off for, what, 10 straight games of 30-plus points, including 37 on Monday. Giannis has played great. The Bucks had a 15-game winning streak since that last straw poll was put out. So, yeah, I think it has tightened considerably. And if the vote was taken today with that straw poll, I think you'd see some very different results. And, like, for me, the last 2.5 weeks are going to be impactful here. Like, if the Nuggets take off in the last 2.5 weeks and Jokic plays great, they win the Western Conference by, like, 7 games instead of the 3.5 they're up by right now, that's going to register for me. If Embiid continues to play well and the Sixers continue to win, something about those 10 games that, you know, Embiid has been on a tear, 8 of them Philadelphia has won. So that means something. And the Sixers right now, I think, are percentage points behind Boston for that number 2 seed in the East. Same thing with Giannis. I mean, look, I think you have to give Giannis credit for not just playing outstanding, but having the Bucks with the best record in the NBA, despite the fact that Chris Middleton has played 27 games. Like, everybody else has a pretty great co-star or two, whether it's James Harden and Tyrese Maxey in Philadelphia. You've got, you know, Jamal Murray, Michael Porter Jr., Aaron Gordon in Philadelphia. I mean, look, Giannis isn't surrounded by stumble bums, but most of the best attributes of his best teammates, well, most of the best attributes of his best teammates are defense, right? Like, Brooke Lopez right now is the front runner for Defensive Player of the Year. Jrue Holiday, good playmaker, all-star, but I think known as much for what he does defensively as what he does offensively. Giannis is number 2, has been out for more than half the season. And that, to me, is something, Herring, that should not be overlooked.
Can I just say something real quick, by the way, while we're on the topic of these three guys? So the Nuggets are playing the Bucks and Sixers back-to-back next week. It should be a huge deal for the NBA. We don't need to get into this whole thing, but the NBA's like refusal to counter-program against the NCAA tournament, to me, is embarrassing. The Nuggets and Bucks are playing on March 25th, which is a Saturday. It should be an ABC primetime game. Instead, it's being shoved onto NBA TV. And it just bothers me that they are willing to be subservient to the NCAA tournament. It's like, this is ridiculous. Stop doing this. I don't care how popular the tournament is. That game deserves to be like sent to as big of an audience as possible.
Or don't schedule that game for
The
NCAA tournament. I think it's in March every single year. I think we know when that's going to happen.
And Michael Malone complained about it the first time, as far as when, I'm pretty sure when it was going to be Giannis.
Second back to back,
Giannis and Jokic matching up against each other. The last four MVPs have gone to those two guys, and you know, they're playing it in a back-to-back scenario, and it didn't make sense, and I thought it was wise to call out. I think Rohan is right on that point too. Everything Chris said is accurate from the standpoint of why this is not an open shut case. First of all, you have three guys that are essentially, I guess, two guys averaging 30 plus for teams that are still in the hunt for a top seed, or at least kind of sniffing around that area. Like you said, one of whom has missed his co-star for the vast majority of the season. And even when he had him for the first part of that, the first chunk of those games was not good. He was not healthy, and you could kind of tell it. And Embiid was playing without Maxey for, what was it, a month and a half? Without Harden for a month. Harden probably should have been an all-star. He wasn't there for a month. So even with regards to where Philly is standings-wise, you know, if he'd had his full complement of guys, you could make the argument that they would have been higher up in the standings. Embiid kept them afloat at a time where they very easily could have, you know, been further down in the standings. What I think for me with Jokic, because Chris made this point as well, Jokic has played fine. It's not like he's been terrible through this rough stretch for Denver. But what I will say is, one, it seems to validate. I think there's no way it couldn't validate the idea that, wow, this defense is really bad and that Jokic doesn't look good in it when they are the worst defense in the league over those 7-8 games that they've struggled. But also because they've been in a number of close games throughout that time too that they've lost, one of the things that sometimes gets criticized with Jokic is that, okay, he's only averaging 25 points, 26 points, whatever, in the midst of averaging these triple-doubles while other guys are going out and getting 35 and 40 every other night. That doesn't bother me until I start to watch some of these close games and some of these close losses to bad teams where Jokic finishes with fewer shots than I think he could take in those games. He is historically efficient. So when you've got games where Jamal Murray is just shooting really, really, really poorly, or other guys, Bruce Brown, for instance, has been really poor since having a great first half of the season, it makes me feel like Jokic could maybe be a little bit more aggressive than he's been. And so that's something that even as he puts up great statistics in those games and plays very well from a traditional standpoint, I'd like to see him maybe take on more of like the sort of stuff that you think of with an MVP. He's wired to be unselfish, but there are times I wish he'd be more selfish. And it's something that's made me think about that a little bit more just as the race tightens and as we get to the end of the season.
He pump fakes out of way too many threes. He needs to be a more willing shooter. I could not agree with you more, Chris.
That's Rowan's next piece for Nuggets.com coming out.
What is it that I can't talk about NBA players now without writing for that team's
Nuggets
website?
Nuggets and Heat.
Okay, it's mister. I had Jason Tatum as my MVP. Okay, yeah.
He was everybody had Jace Tatum as MVP in December.
Yeah. All right.
I did, and that first straw poll too.
Yeah, it was easy. All right,
writing for Brad Stevens' newsletter. Okay.
Yeah, I think people in Boston like me. Are you kidding me? I get clobbered out there on a regular basis. Let's talk about the Lakers. Last week, I made the bold proclamation that the Lakers were going to win the Western Conference. They then went out and laid an egg against Houston and lost at the buzzer to Dallas. Great prediction by me. They did rebound to beat the vaunted Orlando Magic and have a pretty good stretch of games coming up where we're going to figure out exactly who they are as they still wait for LeBron James to come back. So with what we know about the Lakers, actually, before I get into like the contender pretender stuff, look, Anthony Davis needed to play in that Houston game. I know it's, other people have written it. Other people have talked about it. I know what the Lakers are doing. Like, Anthony Davis, like, he's basically a glass menagerie out there. Like, you know, one bump and he's going to fall apart. And I know the Lakers are very leery of that. But if Anthony Davis plays in that game against Houston, the Lakers win. It's as simple as that. The Rockets, I know, they had a moment last week where they beat Boston, they beat LA. But if Anthony Davis plays, they win. And you know, when they went out in that game, my first thought was, man, you know, this feels like the type of game that could, they'll be looking back on saying, man, we're like the seventh seed. If we had a win, we'd be six and out of the play-in. Like, that's a game they will probably live to regret. So they also probably regret the Dallas game where they melted down the stretch with their free throws as well. But anyway, I digress. Where the Lakers are right now, do you look at them, Rohan, as contenders or pretenders in the Western Conference?
I just don't know in what other world this team would be considered a contender when they're in 11th place in the conference. They're not even in the play-in as of today. Their best player now has had years of being injured during critical portions of the season and not able to play. And this foot injury, we don't even really know what it is, but it's serious enough to keep him out of all these important games. Their second best player, to your point, as important and dire as these games are, is not in a position to play back-to-backs. I'll hold my hand up and say, I didn't think the trade that they made at the deadline would move the needle as much as it did for them. I think those players have been much better fits than I thought they would. The defense has been better than I thought it would. even without LeBron in this stretch since the Mavericks game, they're 6-5. That's pretty good considering how quickly the team has historically fallen apart without him during his years in Los Angeles. But I know that there's some concern about the top of this conference. You know, could they beat the Kings? Could they beat the Nuggets? The Suns have their own injury issues. I just think when push comes to shove, we've seen now for a couple years in a row, I don't know that I can count on the health of LeBron and Anthony Davis. I still think in a playoff series, they're going to have issues defensively, particularly in the backcourt. And I understand the pull to call them a contender. I definitely think a first-round match between them and the Kings, for example, would be fascinating to watch. I don't know who I would pick, but the idea that they could last four rounds, I just don't see it happening. So I have to go pretender. Just there's an overwhelming amount of evidence other than like your argument for contender is like they have LeBron, which is a really good argument, but I'm just not seeing it.
Oh, it's more than just they have LeBron. They have LeBron in a conference that doesn't have a 2016 to 2020 Warriors.
Sure.
They have LeBron and AD in a conference where if you were picking a team with top two players, you'd probably still pick them if they were both healthy going into the postseason. So, you know, there are a lot of reasons. And you mentioned where they stand in the standings right now. And yeah, they're in 11th place, but they're one game back in the loss column of sixth. So, like, this is the kind of thing that by the time people listen to this podcast, the Lakers could be in, you know, seventh in that moment. But, Herring, what's your take on a contender, pretender for the Lakers?
I mean, it's not the easiest call. I think I would lean closer to contender just because.
What?
Here's my reason, though. Like, would it stun people?
Can we just say, by the way, Rohan is like, if we did Heat contender pretender, he'd say Heat or contender. Just to be
no,
clear
I wouldn't. I literally wrote a story about the Heat being pretenders, Mannix. I'll send you the link. Don't worry, you must have missed that one.
So I'm not coming down decidedly like, oh, they're contenders, no question. But the thing is, with how well they've performed, and by that I don't necessarily mean wins losses, because we're talking already about the fact that. They lose games because, you know, Anthony Davis sits out. So the whole of the team is kind of what I'm focused on. And if they're healthy enough by the time that LeBron gets back, they've already, since the trade deadline, I was looking at this tweet from Trevor Lane from Lakers Nation. Ninth in net rating, first in defensive efficiency, ninth in pace, number one in free throws attempted, number one in opponents' free throws attempted, meaning that they've limited those. It's a team they've managed to do this without LeBron, and for the most part without LeBron. And so if you add him to that and it clicks, and it, I mean, we only, what did we get, one game of that with LeBron playing with the new guys on this team? I think we got one game of it. So we didn't see enough to know. Do I think it's really likely? No, but is it more likely that they could really beat a good team in the first round? They could maybe take down the Kings in the first round and then be competitive in the second round, which at that point, if you're able to do that, if you're able to get to the conference semis and get to a 6-7 game series, by definition, aren't you kind of a contender at least to win the conference? Like, I don't think it's that far-fetched. It doesn't mean that it's an automatic thing for them. There's questions, certainly. I wonder, too, as we sit and talk about them and the Kings might also blow the doors off them just because of how much offense they have and how fast they are. They have a lot of – they have literally the most cohesion in the league compared to the Lakers that might have the least, considering them and maybe the Suns. But I would say the Lakers because they had a package trade that, you know, swapped in and out three or four people. So – I think that the potential is there. It's LeBron, so I'm not willing to just say that they're not contenders based on the profile that they put together without him, and then they're going to add him to it as well.
Yeah, I'm going to stick with my original prediction that the Lakers win the West. I'm not backing down one bit from that. The Mavericks game bothered me more than the Rockets game. Like, the Rockets game, you can kind of put your finger to and say, you didn't have AD, that's why you lost. The Mavericks game, they did have AD. He didn't play great. They, you know, bricked free throws down the stretch. You got to beat Dallas at home. You gotta.
It was also like
Max
Kleber
beat you
the third or fourth time this year where Anthony Davis. Credit to him, but he's had to, after a loss, been like, that was my fault. Like, that's like, yeah,
he didn't play well.
Not a great season for him.
He didn't play well in that one. But I'm still buying the Lakers. Herring, you mentioned some of the statistics. They're jumping up in a lot of key categories. But look, when we record this next week, I don't know what my opinion's going to be. Because you look at the schedule, and you've got a game on Wednesday against the Durantless Suns. That should be winnable at home, even though Phoenix is still pretty good without Kevin Durant. Then you play Oklahoma City, which is motivated solely by getting Shai Gilgeous-Alexander on the All-NBA team, and that's about it. You got them at home. Then you've got back-to-back Patrick Beverley revenge tour games against the Bulls. So you've got winnable games. Like, they should come out of this next four-game stretch with three wins. Like, they should beat the Bulls a couple of times. They should beat Oklahoma City at home. Maybe you beat Phoenix in a toss-up type of game. But to me, this next stretch is going to be really telling about the state of the Lakers. I think even if they come out 500, that's not good enough over these next four games. But if they win three of the next four, chances are when we record this next week, they're sitting in the seventh seed at worst at that point, because they'll have a win over the Thunder. They'll, you know, gain some ground on maybe Utah. Like, I'm still buying into the Lakers despite a debacle of a week last week where they lost some very winnable games. That's, and look, it all clearly is contingent on LeBron being healthy, but I think they still have enough to get into the play-in. And if LeBron is playing in the play-in, I'm going to buy them all day long. That's kind of where I stand.
But if they get the one seed, if they have to play the Nuggets, and then
I still think they can beat the Nuggets. Like,
But the fact that you and a lot of other people would think that they can, and if that's the case, the discourse around MVP and how that turns out.
Oh my goodness. The negative or anti-Jokic contingent would be loud. And probably right. Like, look, that's a different conversation, but you know, if Jokic flames out early in the playoffs, and not just first round, he flames out in the second round, you know, the critics of him will have a valid argument to make. That's a conversation we'll get into later on.
Can we all agree that the funniest outcome would be Embiid winning the MVP and losing in the second round?
Yes, because Embiid supporters conveniently never mention the fact that Jokic has been to a conference finals and Embiid hasn't.
Correct.
Yeah. Embiid and the Sixers lost to the vaunted Atlanta Hawks a couple of years ago in the conference semifinals.
What do you mean? The Hawks have been great since then.
Yeah. They're tearing it up. A lot of stability that front office, too, and the coaching bench.
Yeah.
John Morant, he is back most likely, it seems, on Wednesday in the Grizzlies game against Houston. It will have been nine games that Ja Morant, he will have been suspended for the full eight games. It'll be nine games that he will have missed since the incident in the Denver nightclub where he flashed a gun. Eight-game suspension by the NBA. He was available on Monday, did not play. There needed to be some kind of ramp-up for Morant before he gets out there. The Grizzlies have had some problems since then. Brandon Clark, done for the season, Achilles tear. Dylan Brooks, still a great defensive player, but as volatile perhaps as he's ever been. So, Herring, with Morant scheduled to return on Wednesday, and the Grizzlies still in that second-place-ish position battling Sacramento, is this season still salvageable in Memphis?
Yeah. I mean, obviously you could tell by the tone in which I answered that, how I feel. Steven Adams, like, becomes massive for them, and it doesn't sound like they're expecting him back until maybe right before the season's over or, you know, right at the start of the playoffs. It's a team that offensive rebounding matters a whole lot to, and also that we've thought of, you know, the Grizzlies historically being like this grit and grind franchise. Obviously Ja can jump over buildings and stuff like that, but they are still a physical, annoying pest of a team between Jaren Jackson, Steven Adams, even, you know, Dylan Brooks certainly has that reputation. He also has a reputation for other things. But I just don't see them getting very far. I think Brandon Clark and Steven Adams being out becomes too big of a problem. We know that they've won a ton of games, you know, 20-5 or whatever they were last year without Ja. Tyus Jones is going to bring it every night and be a, you know, the best backup in the league and fill in for Ja. But it's I just don't see it if they don't have the physicality that they've had. I mean, I think that frankly, between the physicality and also their athleticism is part of why even when Ja went down last year against the Warriors, that they were able to win that massive blowout game. And I think maybe even take one other game from the Warriors. I just don't see it if Steven Adams isn't right or if he's not healthy. So I'm willing to give them a slight chance, but to me, it just feels like it was too uneven of a season. I think at one point they were actually my favorite to come out of the West, but it feels like too much has happened since then. I hope I'm wrong. I hope that they're interesting. I hope that they're compelling. I hope that Ja is still his normal self as far as his ability. But it just kind of feels like there's been too much swirling above this team on top of the fact that as all this was happening, Brandon Clark is out for the season and Steven Adams isn't right.
Yeah, I will say I've been impressed. They've won 6 of their last 7, I believe, which is pretty good. All of those obviously without Morant. They've typically played well without him. My bigger concern with them, I think, is, you know, we talked about this after the trade deadline. I just don't know that they did enough to upgrade their roster. The Brandon Clark injury hurts a lot. He was really, really good for them in the playoffs last year. Like, he came in and really changed some of those playoff games against both the Wolves and the Warriors. But I just look at their rotation. Like, are we going to get serious Aldama minutes in the playoffs? Are we going to get serious Conchar minutes in the playoffs? David Roddy? I'm just going through their rotation. I mean, I think they have a top 5 when Adams is healthy that's as good as kind of any top 5 in the league. They have a really good starting lineup. Dylan Brooks, as annoying as he is, I'm enjoying the Dylan Brooks experience overall. I think we need more unsanitized villains like him in the league, but I just don't think they have enough shooting. And when they lose a guy like Kyle Anderson, like they did in the offseason, they traded away D'Anthony Melton. Like, who are their? You're going to need a 7th guy at least in the playoffs. They have Tyus Jones. Like, is it going to be Luke Kennard? Like, who's going to play in the front court? You know, Xavier Tillman, I think his minutes go up and down in the playoffs. We know Jaren Jackson Jr. is going to be in foul trouble. So, like, are you counting on Aldama to pick up major minutes in a round 3 playoff game? I just don't see it happening. So, to me, my questions really come down to the youth of their rotation and the fact that their shooting is just, I don't think, good enough when the game slows down.
I think Luke Kennard's been good for them. He's playing, what, 20, 25 minutes a game, shooting like 48% from 3. So he's kind of been as advertised. He's just not the kind of two-way player that they were looking to get, whether it was OG Anunoby, Bridges in Brooklyn, Mikal Bridges in Brooklyn. Like, he just is what he is. He can space the floor and give you spot minutes. I actually think they are the most vulnerable of the top 3 seeds to lose early. Sacramento, they don't defend anybody, but they have great continuity, great chemistry. They've either played the most games together with their lineup or top 5 in the NBA in that category. Denver, if they're fully healthy, I think they'll be fine the next couple of weeks. I mean, that's the team I'd want to play if I was a 6, 7, 8 seed. Yeah, you've got to contend with Ja, but if Steven Adams continues to be out, and look, they're not saying Steven Adams is definitely going to be back in a few weeks. They're basically saying they're going to reevaluate him in a few weeks. Good point. So that's not encouraging. And Clark, Rowan, to your point, he was invaluable to them in the playoffs, a strong role player last year. I mean, you got to still contend with Morant and deal with Dylan Brooks' defense. And yeah, they've been great against the Warriors this year, but I'd want to play them in the first round because, yeah, look, they're a great defensive team overall, but they still don't defend the 3-point line incredibly well. And their half court offense is average, league average at this point. So I just, I'd want to play them in the first round. And we still don't know what Morant's going to be like. Like, I tend to believe he's going to be fine when he comes back. He's going to be the Ja Morant that we've seen all season long. If you watch the game on Monday, he was just bathed in adoration when he walked onto the floor by the Memphis crowd. He's going to be re-embraced by everyone there. So I think it's going to be fine individually as far as Morant goes. But they've just suffered too many losses. It's been too combustible a season for me to believe in them. I mean, we could say this about the bottom of the Western Conference with anybody, but if it's Warriors, Clippers, Lakers, Mavericks, the teams that are in that mix for that 6-7-8 seed right now, if I was them, I'd want to play Memphis in the first round. A tough place to play in Memphis. FedEx Forum is bumping in the playoffs, that's for sure. But I'd want to play that team probably more than I'd want to play Denver and more than I want to play Sacramento.
I'll echo that. So. I do think that they are going to be vulnerable in the playoffs, and it's going to be fascinating to watch that play out. I really hope we get a Warriors Grizzlies first round matchup. I'm pulling hard for that. Adam Silver. Look,
the Warriors.
If the league is rigged,
the Warriors need to have Wiggins back for that. Yeah. We have no idea what's going on with him, but if they don't have Wiggins back, they'll lose. Just like they've lost every game against Memphis this season, they'll lose that series too without Andrew Wiggins. Last thing I want to talk about. It was reported by ESPN this week that Michael Jordan is, it seems like, moving towards selling his majority stake in the Charlotte Hornets. It seems like Jordan will stay on as a majority owner, but he will transfer the majority of his shares, his stake in the team, to two of the minority owners of the Hornets. Jordan bought the team from Bob Johnson back in 2010 for price of a hot dog, comparatively speaking, like $175 million. That team's probably going to have a valuation of in the neighborhood of $3 billion, most likely.
No way. That's really?
An NBA team. $2.5, $3 billion.
Oh, yeah, my God. It'll be up for there. The Charlotte Hornets? Oh, my goodness.
It doesn't matter. I mean, the Phoenix Suns, I know they're in Phoenix, and that's a nice destination, but what was their valuation? $4 billion? Like, come on.
Oh, my goodness.
The Hornets will get a $3 billion valuation. Under Jordan's leadership, the Hornets have done nothing. Like, they've had, two or three first-round appearances. They've drafted poorly. They've got a reputation for being really cheap. Their practice facility is in their arena. Like, it's one of the worst, if not the worst, practice facilities in the entire NBA right now. Herring, is Michael Jordan's stewardship, ownership of the Hornets, does that diminish him at all? Like, he's always going to be, Michael Jordan, greatest player of all time, arguably. But it has been a abject failure in Charlotte. If this is the end of the road for Jordan, it has been a failure. And without knowing the outcome of the draft lottery, it's not like the future is very bright. Like, LaMelo Ball is there, said recently he's happy in Charlotte. He's probably just happy to get that next contract in Charlotte. Then we'll see what happens. But they're bad. And outside of hitting the lottery and getting Victor Wembanyama, I don't see a pathway to them getting better anytime soon.
To me, they're two relatively separate things. In the same way that, like, Magic Johnson not being a model executive, and you take that however you want. I mean, he actually is a model executive, but not from an NBA standpoint. I mean, he's a great businessman, I think. Not a very great late night talk show host. I just think that they're two both TOO and TWO separate things for me. I do think, and the most I marry those things in my mind is the idea of, like, Michael would hate playing for this team. And so maybe there is something to be said for that of, like, how can't you manage it better? But also, we've watched people be coaching flameouts. We've watched Phil Jackson be an executive flameout. I already mentioned Magic Johnson. Most people don't have a second act as far as this. I mean, Pat Riley has been obviously wildly successful. But most people really aren't good at two aspects of the same thing, if you could really call it that. The frustrations that I would have if I'm a fan is that, like you said, the team has been cheap. I think we all think of Michael Jordan as just being this uber wealthy owner because, like, you know, there are very few athletes that have ever touched that stratosphere of money. Mm-hmm. The reality is there's a reason that very few athletes have touched the stratosphere of money. They don't have it to buy a team. So it's like the reality for why he might be cheap or why the team might operate in a cheap fashion relative to everybody else is that he's not Steve Ballmer. You know, it's you know, it's different.
Yeah, but that's always, Herring, that's always the high end of it, right? Steve Ballmer's richer than everybody. But
right.
Like Michael Jordan's net worth is $2.1 billion, according to Forbes. He's got a seemingly endless revenue stream with the Jordan brand. He's got the cash. Like I don't believe that he's less wealthy than Tillman Fertitta in Houston. I don't believe he's
that's
less
not a good example to use though.
maybe all right, but how about this? I don't believe he's less wealthy than Wick Grosbeck in Boston. Like I just don't believe it.
Okay,
He's got the cash, and for whatever reason, he refused to spend it. Not just on payroll, which is one thing. Like coaching. You don't have to just go out there and bloat your payroll because that doesn't always work. But I mentioned the facilities, which are awful. Like you guys have been down to Charlotte and gone to their arena and walked onto their practice floor, which is small. I've never been in their weight room, but I read about it being small as well. From what I read, like there's plans to build a new practice facility in the future somewhere in Charlotte. But in the 10 plus years Jordan has owned this team, they have not broken ground on that up until this point. And that matters. And so too matters that Jordan's never really hired a expensive, high profile head coach. It's been like Steve Clifford 17 times and... Right. You know, you've had James Borrego in there. Again, don't have to splurge on coaches.
I like
if
James Borrego,
right,
by the way. I really like
James Borrego a lot. I thought he got a raw deal at the end in Charlotte. But they didn't spend on head coach. When you talk to people down there, they do have one of the thinner front offices in terms of scouting department and personnel. They have not invested in a lot of assets when it comes to the front office, and that, which is kind of well known around the league at this point. That's on Jordan. Like every team wants to have a bunch of people that work there. Jordan elected not to spend. Now he's done some good things. I mean, Adam Silver would be quick to tell you that, you know, what, 5-6 years ago, Jordan was heavily influential in the CBA negotiations because he was really able to bridge the gap between player and owner, because who else could do it better than Michael Jordan? So he has that in his positive column, but you can't get past the fact that a guy with billions of dollars refused to invest much of it in his team. And that, I think, has been a negative for Jordan and continues to prevent the Hornets from really becoming any kind of destination. Like, yeah, players make you a destination, and if LaMelo Ball becomes a superstar, he will attract free agents to come down there and play with him. But players know who has great facilities. They know who has the beautiful practice facility. They know who has the great arena. They know all these things. And Charlotte has not built that kind of infrastructure in the city. And that, and after a decade or 13 years now, that falls on Michael Jordan.
Yeah. I mean, there's some stuff, too, that just, you know, I thought it was smart of them to, obviously, in hindsight, was smart of them to decide not to, because the Kemba Walker thing was such a big deal of like, well, this is the biggest star you've had. Are you going to let him walk? And they made the decision to do that.
And they knew. They knew his knee was questionable. Mm-hmm. They knew.
Right. I think the challenge is that they just haven't drafted well enough, which probably does get back to the point you were just making about how much are you investing in your front office to really find great players at that level, or kind of under every rock, behind every tree sort of thing. They haven't hit on enough of those. They've made some bad, really bad calls. The Nick Batum contract for them was brutal. But also,
oh man,
you know, when you have a good roster around guys, you're asking guys to do a little bit less. Then, you know, if you have a bad roster, you're asking everybody to do a little bit more or a lot more. And, you know, Nick Batum bounced right back right after that. He was good before that. So a lot of it points to what you're saying, Chris. I agree.
Well, yeah. Look, Rohan, let me just throw some facts out there on
please.
the the resume of the Jordan-led front office. Just a few of them. They gave a bunch of assets for Bismack Biyombo back in 2011. That didn't work out. They drafted Shea Gilgeous-Alexander, wound up trading him for Miles Bridges, which before Bridges had his recent incident with domestic violence, that didn't look that bad. But right now, Shea Gilgeous-Alexander is looking like an All-NBA guard, and Bridges is not with the team. They drafted Frank Kaminsky over Miles Turner and Devin Booker. And a recent draft pick, James Bouknight, he's athletic. That's about it at this point. So, like, yeah, would they have drafted better if they had a deeper front office? If they put more people around Mitch Kupchak, who, look, has a great reputation as a general manager from his time with the Lakers, but would they have done better? I don't know, but they didn't. They didn't put these pieces around their top executives in the front office, and the result has been a decade or more of mostly bad decisions made when it comes to personnel. And I didn't even mention Gordon Hayward in that, you know, absurd contract that got them nowhere.
Yeah. To me, this discussion just comes back to what it really shows is your on-court success really does not translate to you being a good front office executive. That's what it comes down to when you have, like you said, probably most people's greatest player of all time, just unable to do anything coherent. And like you said, he's been cheap. He's also, there's times where he's been the bridge to players. There's other times where I think players have gotten into it with him when it comes to collective bargaining stuff and have been upset with where he stood on certain issues. So, yeah, I think it'll frankly, in the long run, be better for his legacy that he's stepping away now instead of kind of just presiding over this for a long time and, you know, people just remembering him as a cheap owner and, you know, a new generation of players being like, why is this team so bad? Like, if anything, he should have gotten off the ship earlier, you know, good for him for cashing out. But I think legacy-wise, long run, this is probably the right move just to get stop being associated with this as quickly as possible. But yeah, there's really just no rhyme or reason to what makes a great front office executive. And I think we're seeing that with Michael Jordan, where I think you could argue what made him great as a player is what makes him not good as an executive. It's just like, hey, do this better. I was able to do it right. We kind of saw that to an extent in The Last Dance as well. So I'm not worried about his legacy taking a hit. It is. I'm more so just, you know, the NBA, it just has these franchises that feel like a black hole sometimes. You know what I mean? It's like, what a just a waste of time. Charlotte has been largely, I mean, and I say that,
yeah, that's how they're run. Yeah. It's because of how they're run. Like, yeah. Oklahoma City is not a destination,
right,
but the
right.
Thunder have been a functional franchise for, you know, more than a decade now because they're extremely well run. Because Clay Bennett went out there and hired Sam Presti and told him he could do whatever the hell he wants. And Presti has built that team into at one winner and now has it on a path to being another. Like, I look, there are always going to be some guys that don't want to play in Oklahoma City or in Charlotte or right. Milwaukee. That's just going to happen. It's just the way it goes. But like when LeBron was in Cleveland, guys wanted to play with him. Like, you know, when you just go, you players want to be in winning situations as much as anything. They do. And Charlotte has never shown that they can operate like a winning situation. I mean, frankly, Michael Jordan's tenure with the Wizards as a player was better than Michael Jordan's tenure with the Hornets as an owner. Like, it was.
It was.
Like, he has.
It was, though.
It just hasn't. It hasn't worked out at all.
It's depressing, and you were right, just having been to Charlotte. It's, yeah, man. I'm very fascinated to see if anyone can turn it around there at this point.
It can be turned around. You just, look, everything can be turned. All you have to do is look at, like, Team X's draft history. That's what I always look at when I'm evaluating how a team got there. That's what it always boils down to. Like, if you draft well, you are not going to be in this shitty situation. If you draft poorly, you are going to find yourself in this situation. It's as simple as that. And I mentioned just some of them. Like, if they had drafted Devin Booker over Frank Kaminsky, where would they be? If they had held on to Shea Gilgeous-Alexander, where would they be? Like, they'd
also
be in a much better position.
I'm going to add this in, too, just because I remember seeing the reports about it, then it kind of went away after Woj reported it. The Miles Bridges stuff, if they bring that guy back, like,
Yeah, I think they floated that out there. As
they
a test
floated it. I hope it was just a trial balloon. But like, if they bring him back and they continue to suck, they'll deserve it. Like, I'm not an advocate of people not getting second chances, but I'm telling you right now, just as we sit with the Ja Morant thing and we're like, what can actually be learned in a week? Essentially, that whole thing with the Miles Bridges thing, I hope he's gotten help. More than anything, I hope that the woman that he was with has gotten help and everything that she needs first and foremost. But I don't like that. That was just such an ugly thing. And it was very publicized, like what was said and what allegedly happened, what essentially did happen, given the way he pleaded. So I would hate to see them, whether it's under Michael or anybody else, we're so desperate to win that we're going to go bring him back. I don't know what the
Do you think Miles Bridges belong? Like, I actually think Miles Bridges should get another opportunity at some point. Like, he will have effectively served a one-year suspension out of the NBA, not making a dollar. Whenever he comes back, the NBA is probably going to slap him with a 25-game suspension for what he pled to. So, like, I feel like a season and a half is a proportionate response to what Miles Bridges did in terms of punishment. I don't believe Miles Bridges should be exiled from the NBA forever.
Okay. So then if that's the case, like, maybe that's fair. I'll be real with you in saying that I'm not exactly sure what his penalty should look like. I haven't really thought that far ahead. No. I know that floating it in the middle of the first season that he's out felt inappropriate to me.
It did. Oh yeah. And they knew that, like, believe me, when that was put out there, and I think you had Bridges show up at a game in Los Angeles, right? He was sitting in the stands. Mm. I think they felt the backlash at that point. And,
okay. Yeah, because we haven't heard a thing about it since then. And that you're right. It does kind of feel that way. I think he, at some point, assuming that he – I hope he does put in some work, get some sort of counseling, meaningful counseling for him. To me, when I say that there should be real things, real steps taken here – I don't think that you like who's going to feel comfortable giving that dude like a long contract after that. So if that's
nobody.
Okay. Yeah. So maybe we'll have to see what it looks like. Maybe it's Charlotte. Maybe it's not. Maybe it would make more sense for Charlotte to be the team because this was the team that kind of raised him. I don't know how that works, but I just know it left a really bad taste in my mouth from the trial balloon aspect of it was very ugly. And it tells you also the direction in which the team seemed to be leaning that they even floated in the first place.
Yeah, what Miles Bridges did was abhorrent, and what he pled to was awful. The question I would ask is what is an appropriate punishment for that?
And it's a fair question. It's a very fair question.
He was in line for a max contract, didn't get it. He has missed this entire season. He's going to miss a chunk of next season. I feel like that's proportional. I feel like that's a reasonable punishment. Now, who will sign him? I don't know. He's not going to get more than like a one-year deal at this point. It's going to be a show-me type of deal from whether it's Charlotte or somebody else. I think Charlotte will still retain his rights even going into next year. He didn't play, so they'll have matching rights on Bridges. But it feels like if he does come back, it will be with Charlotte on a very short-term deal that then we'll see what happens when it comes to that. Fellas, good stuff. Rohan, next week you can go back to discussing like the Jazz and why they've been able to surge despite Lowry Markkanen's injury.
Listen, big win for Will Hardy against his former ball club the other night. How about the Utah Jazz?
Lord.
We're going to have to, if the Celtics keep skidding, we're going to have to talk about them next week, too, because that's an interesting story going into the playoffs. Good stuff, guys. We will do it again next week.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. At Kroger Pharmacy, care is making it easy to get vaccinated. Care is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. Care is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.